Today on Against the Grain, neoliberal globalization, the economic order which has reigned for the last 40 years, has been premised on free trade, with the United States government playing a key role in managing global capitalism. Donald Trump has promised to bring a halt to the export of jobs and the free movement of labor in the form of immigration. So does that spell the end of neoliberalism? I'm Sasha Lilly. Political economist Leo Panitch will join me to talk about trade, the American working class, and right-wing populism in the U.S. and Europe. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Donald Trump made various controversial claims on the campaign trail. He said he would scrap or renegotiate trade deals like the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA. He also stated his intentions to deport up to 11 million undocumented immigrants. We know how mass deportations would pull apart families and brutalize the lives of the undocumented. But how might it affect elites who overwhelmingly supported Clinton over Trump and the system of neoliberalism that they have championed? Few people better understand neoliberalism, with its center in the United States, than Leo Panitch. So in the wake of Trump's electoral victory, I thought it helpful to talk to him about how a Trump presidency would affect neoliberal globalization and the business class in the United States and abroad. Panitch is professor emeritus at York University in Toronto, an editor of the Socialist Register, and co-author with Sam Gindin of The Making of Global Capitalism, The Political Economy of American Empire, published by Verso. I should say, in the interest of full disclosure, that I have a connection with PM Press, which has also published Panitch. Leo, before we get to Donald Trump, I'd like to ask you about what the stakes are, in fact, for the ruling class. You make an argument about the centrality of the United States to global capitalism. Can you sum up what that argument is?
The American state has been the author of the globalization of capitalism, financial capitalism, capitalist social relations, integrated global production, and all the value chains that go with it. Trade agreements are not signed by corporations, they're signed by states, and the American state has played the overarching role in generating this and in facilitating it, in managing its contradictions, not always well, but it's played that central role. That doesn't mean that other states aren't very important. Every time that foreign capital, a multinational corporation, invests in their countries, they need those countries' law courts to protect contracts. They rely on the codification of markets, market behavior, of labor legislation, et cetera. But it has been in this era, the American state, which has been the author of what is known amongst the state managers around the world, in the World Bank, in the IMF, but the individual states, what is known as best practices. And in other words, it's American best practices in its type of neoliberal codification of markets that is the model, and that's sometimes emulated by other governments, and sometimes it's imposed on them.
So the United States plays this rather singular role for international capitalism, and in this election, elites did not get behind Trump. They quite solidly backed Clinton. So what does it mean for the ruling class to have Trump at the helm of U.S. empire?
Yes. So it's a shock to the system insofar as the greatest beneficiaries of this making of global capitalism have been the world's leading multinational corporations, which are overwhelmingly in almost every sector you could name American, and for the major investment banks, which are overwhelmingly based in Wall Street, even when their main operations are in the city of London and so on. So this, insofar as you have a politician, well, in this case, a non-politician elected, who targets the free trade agreements, then it sends a shudder down the spine of the multinational corporations, the international banks, because it's not a matter of tariffs. That they were largely reduced to a level that was satisfactory to MNCs, you know, by the 60s and 70s. No, it's a matter of the free movement of capital, the financial services that these free trade agreements establish, and above all, it's the legal requirement in these agreements that multinational corporations, that foreign capital, be treated the same in the legislation of other governments, in the courts of other governments, as domestic capital, as national capital. So when you have the free trade agreements, above all, the master agreement, the one that was the model for all others, NAFTA, challenged, that undermines this. Moreover, of course, what has gone with neoliberal globalization has been an ideology of open borders, an ideology of internationalism. We see with Trump, but we also saw with Brexit, and we especially see right across Europe with the rise of a xenophobic set of right-wing parties, some of whom are in government in Eastern Europe. You see the same thing developing in the core of the empire, articulating a make America great again, which rhetorically at least is cast in terms of we are going to make other states pay. We feel rather than integrating China into global capitalism, into the value chains that bring the goods to Walmart or bring the assembled cell phones back to Apple. Insofar as that language is articulated as one of conflict rather than one of integration of global capitalism, of course it sends a shudder down their spine. That said, Sasha, let me point something out. People forget that Ronald Reagan was threatening massive tariffs on the world when he was elected. And one of the reasons that we got the free trade agreement between Canada and the United States, which then led to NAFTA, was precisely that Canadian capital, because they were so integrated with American capital, were literally in their pants. And they became they were trying to get out underneath the tariffs that Reagan was threatening. Of course, that threat of tariffs became a lever for the further integration of other states, not only the states of North America, into global capitalism. It was one of the firecrackers that was lit under the European Union's Economic and Monetary Union, which eventually led to the euro. It was one of the things that led those who wanted to keep a trend towards an integrated capitalist world going, that led to the Clinton-Gore takeover of the Democratic Party. And even Robert Reich was doing this. Their argument that there's nothing you can do about globalization, there's nothing you can do about capital movements, what we need to do is retrain, this is Reich's take on it, what we need to do is retrain American workers so they can compete with Vietnamese women working on a dollar a day, or so they can shift to high value added high-tech production, but it competes in the world. And hopefully that will yield enough surplus that we'll be able to drop some crumbs on people. So one tends to forget the extent to which this was a lever, this rhetoric of Reaganism at the beginning, which was an important factor in facilitating globalization. And we should keep our antennae up for the extent to which this will be the case now.
Well, what would that look like, in fact? So are you saying that you're not taking Trump at face value in terms of his rhetoric about tearing these things down?
Well, can you imagine Trump being opposed to free capital movements in his own narrow interests of Trump International hotels and the golf courses he has around the world?
No.
It's inconceivable. And the free trade agreements are primarily about protecting, as I said, foreign capital when it moves somewhere. So from legislation that a domestic state might impose, or from any special regulations that it might impose. And then when that happens, of course, domestic capitalists say, well, you know, you can't have these regulations on the Trump golf courses. You can't have it on our golf courses either. So in other words, I think we should expect that there will be a renegotiation of NAFTA, but it will not touch the provisions on financial services. It will not touch the provisions on Article 11, which protects foreign capital as national capital. What it will do, I would expect, is either do away with or certainly narrow the provisions in the labor and environmental side agreements. It may, in one or two instances, for symbolic effect, although that could have a meaning to a particular group of workers in a particular place, it may impose a tariff on, let us say, motorcycles in order to satisfy the Bikers of America, the Bikers for America, which, you know, were one of his stormtroops in this election campaign. But in general, no, I don't think we are seeing with this. We'll have to see, and, you know, these guys could get out of control. But I don't think we're necessarily seeing a return to high tariffs. In fact, it's almost inconceivable because, you know, the degree of integration of global production is so much broader and deeper than it was in the 1920s. Mm-hmm. Before you saw the introduction, first of all, by the British Empire, and then by, of course, the fascist regimes, and then, you know, including the tariff legislation in the United States in the early 30s, the imposition of that, which did indeed break down the tendencies towards globalization that had developed up to then. They were restored after 1945. It really, to do this would be unbelievably disruptive, and I don't think there's any indication that's his intention. Whether in Europe that's the intention of the right-wing nationalist parties is an open question, but there again, I'm not sure that it really is. Again, you know, one doesn't know how far these things go, but the right-wing nationalist governments that you see in Eastern Europe now are far from it, are not moving in this direction. In fact, they, like Canada, are, you know, the branch plants of German capital. So the likelihood is what we're seeing is a phase of neoliberalism in light of the loss of the ideological legitimation of neoliberalism because of its effects on so many people, and the inability after the crisis to get back to rapid growth and rapid investment in so many places, what we're likely to see is a continuation that does away with the rights of labor mobility.
Right. Well, let me ask you about that. So just staying with the American ruling class for a moment, obviously one of the parts of Trump's agenda that has gotten the most contentious because it's been the most charged has been his campaign promise to deport 11 million undocumented people. And how would that, in fact, affect the American ruling class through all sorts of sectors of the economy? But let's just even just mention agribusiness.
Yes, exactly. So this becomes a major contradiction. And, you know, I don't imagine that they'll get 11 million out. But the logic of the argument here, since, you know, they're not going to return much production to Akron, Ohio, the logic is that the workers in Akron, Ohio, will go down to Palm Springs and water the golf courses and mow the lawns to keep Palm Springs going. That's the logic of it. Now, of course, in an unplanned economy, that could be a recipe, were that the implication of this, for Trump to badly lose the next election. We have to talk about the implications of this for political space, mind you. But I don't think it'll go that far either. I mean, I've been reading that Obama deported 2 million undocumented Mexicans. I do think it does mean that one's going to see, as one sees already in Europe, a closure of the refugees. And one needs to recognize, especially from Central America, how many people who come to the United States are not only economic refugees, but political refugees. Indeed, you could even call many Mexicans who are escaping the gun culture of the drug gangs in Mexico also political refugees. I think we will see a greater, because it hasn't been absent by any means, a greater degree of closure and repression as part of that closure. It's also, I think, likely that we will see with the Trump administration a large, as he said in his acceptance speech, a very, very large infrastructure building program, which will be based on public-private partnerships. You know, these bastards in the Republican Party who promise low taxes and mouth against the Democrats that they want a balanced budget always run up the most massive budget deficits and then leave the Democratic Party to clean up the mess. And I would expect we're going to see that under this administration. Taxes on the rich will be cut, but Trump is a construction capitalist. He's a developer. He's a builder. What he does is provide opportunities for construction capitalists to make money. Now, they employ a hell of a lot of laborers. And we'll have to see, and those laborers, you know, right across the country are very often people from Mexico and Central America. And we'll have to see the extent to which they will be impacted by this attempt to drive people out and not let others in. We certainly can expect, I mean, if this is going to provide jobs, as it would, building highways and bridges, et cetera, if it's going to provide jobs, we can expect they will be the most exploitative and repressive types of employment under this kind of administration, obviously. And we'd have to see as well whether people who are insecure and unemployed, but working, say, at McDonald's wages in the service sector, will move towards becoming, insofar as they're capable of it, depending on their age, et cetera, whether they will move to doing this kind of work. I don't imagine it'll be direct state employment. I would imagine it will be, as I say, public-private partnerships where the American government or American state governments, since there will be subsidies that will flow to state governments, will underwrite the corporate bonds that private developers and construction companies will issue in order to build this stuff, to often charge a toll on it, et cetera. And then if they can't pay it, and therefore the rate of interest on those bonds will be higher than what the Treasury could borrow from directly. The government will, the federal government will pick up and subsidize those corporate bonds if they can't be paid back, or will provide subsidies directly under the table, however, to make sure that the interest costs don't impinge on the profits of these corporations.
Leo Panitch is my guest. He is the author of many books, including most recently with Sam Gindin, The Making of Global Capitalism. I'm Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So returning again to the U.S. as being the center of global capitalism and the uncertainty of having Trump in there, one of the things that you've written about extensively is the role of the U.S., especially through the U.S. Treasury, as sort of global firefighter. When there have been crises, financial crises around the world, do you think that that role of the U.S. will be undercut in any way with Trump being the president? Or do you think there is a momentum to a whole sort of structure that will keep those processes just rolling along?
That's a great question, Sasha. I think virtually no one has been asking that question. I would expect that there will be a lot of amateurism around this. If we look back at Jim O'Neill, Bush's Treasury Secretary, he came in blasting Robert Rubin and Larry Summers at the Treasury for having played that role in the 1998 global financial crisis, but it was mainly began in Asia, and implicitly for doing it in 1994 with Mexico, and it would, caused a cascade of bank failures in New York, the Mexican peso crisis back then, and they were full of, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? And to some extent, things got so bad in Argentina. And Argentina, defaulted on its bonds, and we still are barely seeing the end of the reverberations of that because O'Neill didn't do much about it. So this is very important. And I do think, for what I said, that, this doesn't mean that neoliberal globalization is over. It doesn't mean that it's going to tick along smoothly. And I think that this election will probably have the effect of amongst the anywhere from 4,000 to 10,000 people that are going to be put into place in the key departments of the American state, we are going to see people who won't be good at firefighting, who may not even want to do it, who are inclined indeed to follow the Republican congressman's attempt to undermine the ability of the Treasury to roll over its debt. Now, they, coming up against the reality of things, they have always backed down when they were trying to impose a debt ceiling on the American Treasury. We'll have to see, and this could indeed be a big screw-up. That said, it's not as if the U.S. Treasury under Obama has been all that hot at doing this. In fact, what's been remarkable is how, unlike in the 1990s with Rubin and Summers, when they would read the Riot Act to the Germans with regard to getting active in firefighting as well, the Obama administration, just as it's been lousy in handling Congress, has not been good at all in handling the European Central Bank and, above all, the German government. And the quantitative easing that the Federal Reserve has had to do has, pouring money into the system in order to keep it ticking, has not just been about keeping the American economy going. It's been about ensuring that the New York banks would be lending overnight to the European banks, which are in much worse shape, in order to keep the European economy going. Whereas the Obama administration would have liked to have run much larger fiscal stimulus programs and was prevented from doing so by virtue of having lost the Congress by 2010. That wasn't the case in Europe. And you should have expected a much larger fiscal deficit program, fiscal stimulus program through Europe, but they couldn't get the Germans to do this because they, above all, are obsessed about balanced budgets and making sure that the euro does what the mark used to do, which is facilitate German exports. And that's why you had this very draconian, very, very draconian austerity programs repeatedly put on across Europe, producing depression conditions in Southern Europe, which was not the case in the United States. I mean, at least they managed to contain this crisis that was severe enough, and it hasn't produced high growth or high investment, but it hasn't turned into the depression in the United States.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Today I'm joined by Leo Panitch. He is an editor of the Socialist Register, co-author with Sam Gindin of The Making of Global Capitalism, The Political Economy of American Empire. He's professor emeritus at York University in Canada. It can be very easy to get caught up in American exceptionalism. You know, obviously the United States has very deep racial and ethnic divisions, and one can talk about the politics of celebrity and so on. But clearly there are similar things that have been going on in terms of the support for authoritarian and right-wing populism outside of the borders of the United States, especially in Europe. And of course, right now in France, you have the xenophobic leader of the far-right National Front, Marine Le Pen, hoping that she will somehow sweep to power this spring. So what is the commonality that binds these disparate places together in terms of the appeal of a certain kind of right-wing politics that, at least for the United States, at least in recent history, is somewhat different than the standard fare that the Republican Party has churned out year after year?
Right. These are the morbid symptoms of capitalism. Of an increasingly irrational, chaotic, exploitative, and grossly unequal system. And as neoliberalism has created enormous insecurity, as it flexibilizes labor, as it makes everyone competitive, as it produces a precariat, all of that produces anxieties. And remember, globalization was never about bypassing states. It was always about running it through states. That involved the reproduction of national state identities and capacities, for that matter. So people didn't stop thinking of themselves as French or German, or least of all American. In the context of the growing insecurity, in the context of the inability since the crisis, to be able to sustain even consumption as people have had to repay their debts, lost their houses, etc., not sure whether their credit cards would tick over, you know what I'm talking about. In that context, there has been a turn to right-wing parties. Now, why do right-wing nationalist xenophobic parties? They have appealed to national identity, to a cultural exclusiveness. That's a very old appeal in the face of insecurity. And it's been reinforced by the fact that there has been, to begin in Europe, a good deal of labor mobility in Europe. Some of it has been about getting cheaper labor into certain places, whether it's cheap Polish plumbers into France or cheap Romanian waiters into London. And that has helped fuel this. Of course, on top of that, there's all, and you see that in with Latinos, especially Central Americans and people from Mexico coming into the United States. But it's been reinforced by political conditions in so many places around the world, from Central America to North Africa and the Middle East, which produces refugees. Now, all of that is a recipe for nationalists to take advantage of this. And they're doing so as in a way Trump is doing, and certainly this guy from Breitbart, or Breitbart in general, has done, by not so much explicitly admitting that they're racist, but rather than saying, look, we have a certain culture here, and the other culture is just fine, we've got nothing against it, but they ought to be practicing their culture on another street, in another place, and preferably in some other country. And you know, you see that coming up commonly. Now, why is this coming up to the extent it's coming up? You can't understand it without understanding it in the context of the defeat of trade unionism, which goes back to the 1980s, you know, more important than what Volcker did at the Federal Reserve in raising unemployment deliberately to break the backs of the unions, was Reagan's defeat of the air traffic controllers, was the filling of the National Labor Relations Board with his appointees, which made it hard for people to unionize, in fact, caused a deunionization, disorganization. And you know, similarly with Thatcher in Europe, and even in Germany and Scandinavia, where if unions weren't busted, they were flexibilized. That's one dimension of this. The other is the utter bankruptcy of the Social Democratic parties, and with that of the Democratic Party, who have used their ties to the unions to impose a globalization strategy of competitiveness, of flexibilization, facilitating this insecurity, you know, and promising steel workers, auto workers, that, you know, they'll get them jobs at some high-tech retrade industry, but of course they don't and can't. And the utter bankruptcy of those parties, the social democratic parties in Europe, the Democratic Party in the United States in this respect, has finally, it's coming to roost. And I'm sure, you know, all of your listeners are all too aware of this. So it isn't just a matter of what capital does. It isn't just a matter of what these horrifically opportunistic and xenophobic politicians do. It's also a matter of the utter bankruptcy and failure of social democrats, of the Democrats, and one must say the union leaders who continue to act as their agents. And you really saw it this time. I mean, the most unbelievable strategy whereby, you know, you ignore the needs and interests of workers who voted for Obama in 2008 in Michigan, actually encouraging in the Republican primaries candidates like Trump, like Cruz, on the strategy that you're going to pull in moderate Republican businessmen or their wives who want to see a female president. And you know, that is what we have come to. Increasingly, you had a aspirational identity politics embraced as the egalitarian dimension of these parties. Now, what the heck does it mean to most women in the world when you say, I'm going to break the glass ceiling for CEOs? What does it mean for most black people in the world when you say, I'm going to get an equal proportion of people into Harvard as there are blacks in the American population, rather than saying we will have free post-secondary education of a high quality right across the country? Of course, eventually people are going to smell this, however much the media does, of course, give them some sense that these aspirational mobilities are really going to serve them. They're not. On the contrary, you see an increasing diminution in the number of working class kids, whether they're black, Latino, white, whatever, who are moving into the upper strata of the profession, let alone the upper strata of the bourgeoisie. This has been a disaster. The fact that so much of the left has not been willing to question it is, and I mean by this, the socialist left, the radical left, have been yelled down, shouted down every time that they have by others who are very progressive in social terms, but for whom this is the priority, has turned out to be a terrible problem.
Well, let's then continue on the question of the working class, which in essence you're bringing up here. You have argued that neoliberalism is not just about class war from above, although it is that, but it's also about integrating the working class into finance through things like mortgages and pensions and credit cards, so that workers end up in this very complex position where they have a stake in seeing the system continue on some level. Where do you see the Trump presidency leaving the working class?
Really, that's a very, very good question. You know, I think that part of the reason for the Trump election is that the way in which working people have been integrated into this is becoming frayed. I think that's what the explosion of the subprime debt market already indicated. Bill Clinton was seen as the black president, not because he played the saxophone, but because he was so proud about providing black communities who were previously redlined by the banks from being able to get mortgages. He opened the door to them doing so. Then, of course, the Bush administration let every shyster into the business, and you know, 10,000 people who had fraud convictions were selling subprime mortgages in Florida. But it was Clinton who proudly, you know, laid the way for this. Well, that's come apart, obviously, and heaven knows, not only for people in black communities. In the wake of the crisis, in the wake of the 2007-2008 crisis. You know, what one, I don't know, you know, how much the payday loan system is ticking over or not ticking over, but one needs to look carefully at the extent to which there is the ability to continue to purchase through credit. One wonders whether, despite the, you know, the rise in employment, whether the fact that growth isn't all that great in the United States and elsewhere does have to do with the inability to keep on consuming through borrowing all the more. Moreover, insofar as workers' pension systems are increasingly being turned into not defined benefits, but defined contributions, workers are much less secure in their pension plans. They may not even have any increasingly. And therefore, the role that the people who control these pension funds play in investing in capitalist projects in the stock market and the corporate bond market, et cetera, may be fraying as well. Now, I'm not saying that most workers are actually very conscious of these kinds of connections, but it is the way in which they get tied into the system. So I think some of this is fraying, and I think that is showing in the desperation that people are having in voting for these types of charlatans or you know, these types of rabble-rousers, the xenophobic rabble-rousers. So, you know, I do think, again, we're going to see massive contradictions in this I don't think this, you know, in saying that neoliberalism isn't over because of people like Trump or even Le Pen, perhaps, that is going well. There's a tremendous distrust of the institutions, whether it's the European Union institutions or the mainstream parties. And moreover, even apart from managing the firefighting, you know, we're going to see versions of gangster capitalism, as, you know, we tend to refer to it now only in Russia, or where I am right now speaking to you from Belgrade, you know, all over the place. But you're going to see it now in the United States. And you can expect that, you know, all kinds of stuff is going to blow up in this administration's faces, which will delegitimate them, I would expect. I mean, from Trump on down, you know, there's going to be just one mess after another, because there's so little distance between these people as they operate in the market, now sitting in the state.
How do you imagine, I know you're not an oracle, but how the left is going to fare in the coming 4 years? I'm meaning here the radical left.
Yeah.
On the one hand,
right,
neoliberalism has lost much of its legitimacy, and Trump is in many ways an easy target. He's a figure so many people loathe already, and he hasn't even assumed his position. On the other hand, Trump has a pretty nasty agenda, which looks quite repressive.
Right. So my first reaction is, thank God it wasn't Bernie. I know a lot of people want to say, think, believe that Bernie could have won. And I'm agnostic on that. But had he beaten Hillary Clinton for the nomination, and then lost to Trump, the radical left, the socialist left, would have been set back a generation. Precisely because the soft liberal left, the Clintonites, as the Blairites did with Jeremy Corbyn after Brexit, would have insisted that Trump won, that the xenophobia won, because that of the left, because the left removed the moderate candidate, and this would have been a disaster. The result of this election, at least, is that I think it is the final nail in the coffin of those who are attached to the unions, those politicians, but nevertheless were pursuing a neoliberal global agenda. It is the final nail in their coffin. You know, they already, with the Iraq war, suffered to some extent. And when Ed Miliband replaced Blair in Britain, that was already a repudiation. The Corbyn phenomenon, and then the Sanders phenomenon, the Democratic Party, reinforced that. All I can say is thank goodness it wasn't Bernie. That said, you know, I think that there will be great space for the left to mobilize. A lot of it will be in the Democratic Party. Some of that could be a dead end. I mean, you know, your attorney general in San Francisco may be the candidate people will turn to, and she may turn out to be, may already be, a very conventional mainstream politician.
You mean Kamala Harris?
But she's a new face and a woman of color, et cetera, et cetera. We'll have to see. And if there isn't the type of movement at the base that Bernie's Our Revolution group, which is the equivalent or hopes to be of momentum in the British Labour Party case, you know, if it doesn't, you know, make someone like that accountable or throw up its own new political cadre inside, and I would really hope outside the Democratic Party, you know, then it may not go very far. But who knows, it might. And things, I think, are going to get very, very interesting. I do think that there will be one mess after another in the Trump administration. And I do think that the governor's coalition that began with Clinton and Gore, et cetera, in order to defeat the new politics that had emerged out of the 68 generation of the Democratic Party, that, you know, they're legitimated and finished. So there's space. You know, I would hope that there'll also be space for a transformation of the unions so that they aren't merely the agents politically of very mainstream and in some ways even anti-labor politicians. I'm sure every Democratic Party politician now will offer labor, all kinds of labor legislation. But, you know, they've been offered it before and never come through. So, you know, you're going to need a really a radical transformation of the labor movement. So it really is not only organizing industrially, but radicalizing people politically. One hopes they'll link up with the workers' action centers, which are so deeply embedded in Latino communities, especially. And pick up some of their creativity. You know, we have to hope that when Bernie calls for people to run for dog catcher and mayor, as well as Democratic congressman, people are running in a way that is not exclusively oriented to becoming a career politician inside the Democratic Party apparatus. But people are running in order to invigorate community actions and help develop people's capacities in all kinds of arenas to imagine alternate kinds of production and consumption and communication. You know, what one needs is a fundamental revolution in the way we do politics on the left. And you know, the space is being created for that. Of course, it's a very frightening moment because the space is being created for extremely authoritarian and, in some cases, racist people. And the consequences of that could be a political closure, which won't even leave the space for us to do what we need to do. So I found myself very, very anxious in the weeks running up to the election that Hillary Clinton might not be president. I couldn't believe how anxiety-ridden I was. But it was mainly because I'm afraid of the political closure that may come with this.
So let me end by asking you then, and you are at a conference about utopia in the former Yugoslavia, in Belgrade, in thinking about the coming years and thinking about the struggles of the radical left, there clearly are all sorts of defensive battles that will need to be fought, some of them very clearly in the streets. But do you think this is a moment that we can also not get frozen in defensive battles, since the left and the radical left have been locked into defending things for decades now, and bring some kind of utopian vision into the picture?
Yes, and I think it's already begun. You know, I think that the move that occurred after Occupy, after the indignados in Europe, etc., from protest to politics, was already a move in the direction of realizing that you can protest till hell freezes over and you won't change the world. That's not to say that protesting against injustices should stop. It's not to say at all that the ruling classes don't see those protests and fear them sometimes as something that they can't contain or something that may blow up in their faces or what have you. They do, but there has been a visible shift, which is indicated by the election of Syriza in Greece, even though it was stymied by the authoritarian austerity policies of the European Union, by Podemos in Spain, and inside, those are new parties, but inside the old parties, by Corbyn and Sanders in the United States, there's been this shift from protest to politics. Moreover, it's been a socialist politics. It's been explicitly a rehabilitation of socialism. Now, that's a vague word, but it isn't social democracy. It isn't reforming capitalism. It is saying the system is so fundamentally unfair and chaotic and irrational in face of the climate crisis that we have to imagine an alternative system. So you've already got that. And even though Bernie says, you know, it looked like Denmark, what the hell do people know? As far as they know, I mean, most Americans think that Canada is their Sweden. So, you know, he thinks that you know enough about Canada not to choose Canada. And he's right not to choose Canada. But, you know, there is a utopian dimension to Bernie's appeal. And we can go much further than this. We have to do this practically, not only rhetorically. We do have to have the patience to be able to imagine what we're doing on the left is developing people's democratic capacities, and heaven knows you see it with the know-nothingness of American politics now. We're back to the 1840s in some respects. We need to develop people's democratic capacities, abilities to judge what people are saying in political life, make them accountable, etc., but also develop their capacities, as I said before, to imagine and begin to practice alternate forms of production and consumption, which involves conversion of a lot of what we now do. And you know, this is, it's not a matter of, you know, imagining some future beautiful world. It's a matter of engaging in the type of practical alternatives that we're going to have to undertake in order to have a sane, egalitarian, and ecologically safe form of economy.
Leo Panitch, it's been a real pleasure having you on.
Sasha, I always love talking to you. You know that.
I've been speaking this past hour with Leo Panitch. He is professor emeritus at York University in Toronto, author of many books, including most recently with Sam Gindin, The Making of Global Capitalism, as well as In and Out of Crisis, published by PM Press. And I should say, in the interest of full disclosure, that I have a connection with PM Press. You've been listening to Against the Grain. My name is Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.